a small group. You must be the good singers in our church. Because you were still loud, but you still sounded real well on that. Yes. True. So, I called this play matters. You see what I did there? It works both ways, like play matters, work matters, play matters, but we're also dealing with matters of play. I thought you'd be way more impressed on that by then. I have fun with those. There was a Time article about the rat race of life where it made some observations about our pursuit of pleasure, our pursuit of downtime, of rest or play. And what the article noticed is that people work harder and harder with less time to enjoy what they have earned. So it's like, try to climb the corporate ladder, try to move ahead, try to make more money to get this house, to have these things, and then end up actually having less time to play with those things. The article also talked about, hey, Nick, if you'll go down maybe just a little bit, because I'm hearing myself like twice. It's like the voice in my head, but I put that away while I'm speaking. Thank you. The article also talked about time-saving devices that take more of our time. And just the general explosion of information. You've got technology in your car. You've got technology on your wrist, on your phone, people receiving emails on vacation. Article said there's good evidence showing that before the Industrial Revolution, people did not work longer hours than they have since. And that time that we supposedly save with all these time-saving devices, the time that we save from work, we tend to fill that with activities that resemble work. So the article talked about, you know, the maintenance of all the things that we buy with our extra money, the maintenance of our devices, more paperwork, more education, shopping. And according to the article, those that were hit the hardest were the professionals, because simply to remain competitive, to remain in this rat race, professionals find that their lives usually are one continuous working day, leading into the wee hours, squeezing out any leisure time. And in moments of rest, in moments of vacation, in moments of where we might be playing or doing our hobbies, we tend to bring our work with us. We've all probably experienced this to some extent. Church somewhat buys into that model at times because good Christians are those who are active and busy in the church, right? Those that are offering activity sacrificially, using their gift for the benefit of the church. But rarely is a good Christian known as, hey, they're a person who experiences rest. I've always wondered that, like, how we delineate, what is a good Christian? Like, what's a person that we go, wow, that is a mature, holy follower of Jesus? And if you create our list here in this country, it will hardly ever picture someone who experiences rest. Like, hardly is ever someone commended for refusing to be involved in something. Why? Because doing is better than being. And for a lot of people, Sundays, I think we try here, Sundays can be just as hectic and stressful, if not more so, than the other days of the week. Which is all interesting to me because if you go back, so it's your picture in your mind, we won't actually do it, but you go back to so the Bible is this mammoth library, but if you go back to the very beginning, the early pages of Genesis, why are human beings created? They're designed to walk and talk, I would say, play with God in the garden without shame, reveling in the joy, the freedom, the ecstasy, the ease of the garden. And in the fall, we exchanged a play paradigm for a work paradigm. But if we are to live the lives that we were created to be, if we're going to really bear the mark and image of God, then I think we have to learn to return to that lost art of play. I like that. I like that image. We are created to live a garden life, life of shalom. We are made to play with God the game of tending and tilling the soil. of shepherding his creation. The rhythm that God started in the early pages of Genesis with this, he separates and he fills. And then part of being in the image of God is that we follow that rhythm. We separate, we fill. Even the naming of the animals, that isn't just science, like classifying the animals. That's a real sacred act to name something. It shows connection and play and love. And then Jesus, the second Adam, he comes to replace what we started this game of hide and seek with God. And he comes to replace the game with seek and save the lost. To lead us back into our natural garden habitat of playing and partnering with God. And Jesus calls us with a shepherd's voice, and if you hear that voice and you follow it, you can find your way back into the welcoming arms of God, who's always beckoning you into a place of joy and freedom and intimacy and ease. That's what we left behind. And what you find in God's garden, that his garden is playful instead of workful. It's full of play. Now see, again, I don't hear this said a lot about, like, when you think of mature Christian, that's a real follower of Jesus. Is this included? I would say part of delighting in God is not embracing the world's work fetish, but the garden's playground. Like, if your faith is going to be vibrant, if your faith is going to be alive, if it's going to wrap itself in the minutia of your everyday life, if it's something that's going to work for you, and if that's not happening, then could it be that we're working for God instead of playing with God? Like, for me, I just like to change metaphors sometimes. What if we move from a Protestant work ethic to a paradise play ethic? What would that look like? Because I don't think God is just interested in showing the world how well we work. The mark of the early church wasn't, look at those people, look how well they work. It was, look how well they love. And I'm going to tell you this, the prevalence of love signals to me the presence of play. When there's freedom, when there's ease, when there's this partnering with God, when there's that kind of play, you're going to see a heavy amount of love. Having a play ethic, though, because here's what I mean. Like, what does life look like with we have this play ethic, which means go back to Lent. We had this Lent series where we said, what would it look like for Christians? Like, I think one of the greatest calling for Christians in this era is to have some really down-to-earth, playful, joyful, incarnational people. What does that look like? What would that look like to be people of ease and play? Now, immediately someone's going to come in and spoil the fun and say, well, wait a minute. If you have this play ethic, doesn't that suppress the hardness of life? Like, life isn't all just fun and games. There's a lot of difficult choices to be made. There's difficult things that come into your life. There's sickness, there's illness, there's death, there's relational issues. But here's what I'd say. I think that playing with God, this act of partnering with God, Jesus used the image of yoking with Jesus. I actually think that is the ultimate act of faith. Because it says, God, we really believe that you are who you say you are. We really believe your promises that you've given us in Scripture. We really believe in your providential hand that has worked, and it's bringing about a dynamic present for us. Not an easy present, not a big wide road that has no hurdles in it, but a dynamic present, and I would say an even better future. I think most of spirituality is trusting God in order to get something, and I would say that's not faith, that's self-interest. Most of the time it's like, you know, I go to church, I do this. I know so many Christians that when a difficult thing happens, it's like, God, I do this, I go to church, I serve, I give money here, I read my Bible, I pray. You're supposed to have my back on these other things. So something difficult comes in life, you're like, whoa, you don't have my back. What? See, that's trusting God to get something, which is really self-interest, really doesn't have much to do with faith. Faith is trusting in God because of who he is. That's why the Old Testament, you say he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Who he is, he's this kind of God that's invested in people's lives. I trust in that. And I think when you partner, when you learn in life, when all of us learn to play with God, to have that kind of freedom and ease, to dream with God, to partner with him in projects, I think that frees our faith to trust. I think it allows us to really receive the gifts of life and to then advance joy for all people. I think play brings faith to life. You see, instead of just kind of gritting our teeth, plodding along. There was an immigrant. I think I have a picture here. 19th century immigrant. He was passing through Ellis Island by way of the Statue of Liberty. And he was found walking the tracks of the Lehigh Valley Railroad in New Jersey and basically was carrying everything he had with him from the old country. And he was foot sore and he's fatigued from walking and he's shuffling along the railroads and an agent stops him and tells him, you're going to have to get off the tracks, you're going to get hit by a train or you're going to be arrested for trespassing. And the man refused, and instead of getting off the tracks, he pulled out a railroad ticket that was good from Jersey City to Stanton. And the attendant kind of looks at him shocked, like, you know, why are you walking on the tracks when you could be riding the train? And the immigrant was confused. He thought that the ticket gave him only the privilege of walking the rails. He almost danced for joy when he learned that he could ride the train and not trudge the tracks. How many of you remember an old Beatles song? She's got a ticket to ride, but she don't care. That the Beatles' way of, it's an invitation to love and to play. How often don't we care? That's an interesting line. I wonder if the heavenly host looks down upon us sometimes, slogging along, working our way through life when we've been given a free passage to rise, to ride. Old Testament says to mount, Old Testament says mount up with wings of eagles. That's a picture. See, Christians aren't those, in my opinion, Christians can't be those who just kind of grit their teeth and they're pragmatic and they make life work and they push through the struggles because we know heaven is at the end. But I think we're those who are able to actually make life fun. If you really believe in God's promises, if you really believe he's defeated the ultimate enemy, death, you really believe in resurrection and new creation, that I think there's, remember in Lent series, I wrote this quote down, sadness is hereditary to us, and the devil is the spirit of sadness. But God is the spirit of joy who saves us. And then he finished with this line, you have as much laughter as you have faith. The gospel is nothing less than laughter and joy. See, that's the image. How many of you remember that? I know a lot of people like the Mary Tyler Moore Show look back on that fondly. In our time, there was also Seinfeld. And then you had 30 Rock. And then you had probably the most famous, The Office. All of these are a popular award-winning TV shows. And it's interesting, almost all of them parodied how we worship work and how we work at our play. One of the only positive categories in which the U.S. still shows up as number one in the world is those who work the hardest and the longest. And the problem is we look at those working the hardest and the longest with a badge of honor, right? We do that in the church, bragging rights. I hear this all the time. I don't have time. I'm so busy. And we say that as a badge of honor. Yet Jesus had the same 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and somehow did everything that God had accomplished, had him to do, to accomplish. But we wear that, like in the church, we kind of run in, we give an hour, we barely keep our eyes closed for church, and we run out back to, and that really is a badge of honor. And in the religious world, many have bought into this form of Protestant, like that image, this Protestant work ethic that taught us that the harder that we work, the more successful that we become, the more, you know, God is pleased, the more you know he is blessing you. But God hasn't placed us on the earth to judge us, but to enjoy us. Look at these verses. All things are yours. The things you see, the things that are present, the things you don't see, the things that are still to come, all things are yours. How about this? God gives us richly all things to enjoy. I love this from the Message. We ask you, urges more like it. Only Eugene could write that kind of stuff. That you keep on doing what we told you to do to please God, not in a dogged religious plod. Is that not the best description for the church world and church people? Not in this dogged religious plot, but instead in this living, spirited dance. That's a picture of life. Why are so many of us trying so hard at working so hard when we were created to play, to enjoy our relationship with God, to enjoy our relationship with others, to enjoy the created world? It's as if we've heard Jesus say, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you more work." We see that as a great burden. G.K. Chesterton is one of the few who, in his writings, he approached God as an artist. He talked all the time about creation was creative. And I like this. He viewed God as the ultimate playwright who had created the most incredible of dramas. Messed up by the actors, but one of the most incredible dramas. And his thought was this: the universe, when you look at it, isn't God at work, but God at play. I like that image. So it seems for you and I, because I hear this question like what is just simple Christian life? Like, what does day-to-day Christian living look like? For all of us to bask in the pleasure of God, I think it is to rediscover and to relive this garden story of strolling with God through the world. Walking with God through paradise, yoked in connection and covenant relationship with Him as He clothes us in this seamless robe of mercy and grace. And that every moment we wake up, we say this: God's Spirit has been released on the world. God's Spirit, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, is at play in the world. And the Spirit's playful presence, wherever you are at, is always reveling in the very good of God's creation. That is found in art, found in music, found in relationships, in child's laughter, in liturgy, in literature, all of these things. I love this phrase, tuning our hearts to sing thy praise. What a cool image that is, tuning our hearts. Do you know how long and hard I looked to find that stinking guitar? And God, like, I had something in my head and I had to find it. I love that line, that tune our hearts. Everything and always, all around us, God is around us, God is in us, and they're working together to tune your heart to sing constantly His praise and His grace. God's pleasure is bestowed upon you as a gift. That's what it means to be blessed. You're invited into a relationship. His mercies are new every morning. So every morning, you're invited to a relationship that you didn't initiate, that you're not in control of, but you are a receiver. And the Bible pictures this. I like word images. It says, you have received a robe of righteousness. I think people feel that as a heavy mantle, like an itchy choir robe I have to wear around every day. And I think what we should imagine is those are more play clothes than they are Sunday dress. Like it's a blessing that's been given. I love this image too. The yoke of Christ, that picture in Scripture, is designed to make our work easier. See, we think of these sometimes as heavy. Oh, I'm yoked with Christ. I've got to follow Jesus. I'm wearing the robe of righteousness. No. The yoke of Christ is meant to make everything easier, shared, more playful, more creative. The image is Christ in His bride. See, our walk with Christ, our partnering with God in this world is a lover's bond where we walk through hard things, obstacles, but every opportunity. I think I've hammered this thought process here at this church that Christians don't work towards the pleasure and acceptance of God. You work from it. It is your ground of being. Like that's that robe of righteousness. And then that frees you. Like if that's real, if that's reality, you're the beloved, then that frees you to play. So that every time you approach life with the joy of a child, that's God play at work in you. Every time we're here and you're singing, I thought we sang that song, that second song especially, we sang really well and it sounded beautiful from the back. Every time you praise and worship God and you're receiving his good gifts in your life, that's God play at work in you. Every time you lose yourself in service to others, what is that? That's God play in you. The wonderful, of course you knew I was headed there. The wonderful Wizard of Oz, Dorothy leaves home to discover after multiple adventures that everything good and beautiful was already there in her backyard. Her true promised land wasn't the glitz and glamour that she found in Oz, but it's the relationships with the loved ones that she had left behind but had always known. So the world that she belonged to was actually lost for a time, but then also found. This one's hugely important to me. I think that our backyard is the garden of God that stretches throughout all creation. I think right where you are, your backyard, that is the garden of God. And if I could speak, especially I think to this generation, you don't find God by going somewhere else, but by discovering anew the beauty of the God who is already there. In and with and among us, and he is always inviting you to play. Yeah, your job's difficult. God is inviting you even there to find some freedom and ease in that. To me, I call this, it just sounds better when you say it like this, the sacred art of seeing what's right in front of you. And I got to tell you, it's a gift. When you have it, it's a gift. When there's not always this wanderlust that if I go here, if I go here, if I'm at this place, when you don't have that, that's what Paul meant, to be content. That God's work, his playground, is right in your backyard. I wrote this on my Facebook this week. It's a short sentence. The voyage of discovery is not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. That's the gift of faith. Faith allows you to have new eyes, and then now you have the sacred art of seeing what's right there in front of you, much like Dorothy. And if our lives every day hear that summoning voice that says, come and see, then the world, right where you are, becomes the garden that we're talking about. Let me end with this. This is a weird transition. I'm not doing everything that I was, we're a little bit smaller groups. I'm cutting some things. I'm doing things, and I'm doing it as I'm speaking to you. So that's always a weird thing. I always tell Bruce, it's always funny when you're speaking, and I'm like three sentences ahead, and I'm cutting. Now I'm not going to do that, but I'm still talking to you. I don't know. Our amazing brains, I don't know how that happens. I only feel really smart, though, when I'm speaking, because I feel like I'm multitasking for a change. In real life, I don't multitask well. But I would say this. To end kind of the thoughts tonight, let this be our final thought, that play, we're using this idea, we're using this topic this summer of play. Play is not a pause that refreshes you for a moment and then thrusts you right back into work. Like, that's what we're talking about. When I say play, it's not like, oh, you got to stop, you got to breathe because you're human, you got to stop and smell the roses so that you can just be thrust back into work. So it's a moment's break to go back into work. What I want you to know is that play and rest is good for its own sake. It's good for its own sake. Ever thought of that? This hit me like a ton of bricks this week. There is a playfulness and almost a wastefulness, an extravagance that is built into creation. Ever thought of this? How many millions of seeds that never germinate? How many leaves that turn into brilliant colors and dot the landscape and then die? How many trees and flowers all over the world, millions of them, are displaying their beauty, but no one's there to see it? No one lives close enough. See, some of God's creation, maybe a lot of it, is non-utilitarian, like it seems useless. It's just there. Nevertheless, it is there, and it's there to be enjoyed by God, if no one else sees it. And remember the story when God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. I love it because there aren't theological answers given there, but God just reflects on how much he enjoys his own creation, even though much of it goes unobserved or unused by humankind. Like if you read Job 38, it's just a passage like God enjoys being God. You say, well, you know, if I was God, I would probably enjoy that too, but he does. He does. You don't have this God that's like, oh my gosh, I got to deal with these. Oh, Daniel sent me 100 more emails today. You know, you don't have that. Sorry, Daniel, you're not here very often, so I don't. But he says this, who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Like God played in the beginning as he created the world, and he plays as he holds the world together every moment and as he interacts with it. You remember in the Proverbs, there was the term wisdom, but wisdom is personified in Proverbs. And it says, in eternity before the world began, wisdom played in the Father's presence at creation. I love that image. Then I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight. I love the word delight, by the way. I don't like the word moist, just so you know. I don't use it often, but I do like the word delight. Delight. Day after day, look at this, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in humankind. I run that one, didn't I? I love that picture. God tells Job, the world and humankind are the fruit of this heavenly, playful love. What an image. Job 38, he says it like this, while the morning stars sang together, and all the angels shouted for joy. You know what makes you playful? You know what makes you desire vacation and rest and to play games, to have people over for a barbecue? Why do we do that? Because you were made for the fun of it. There used to be this song that says, the reason for the world, you and I. You were made not for this utilitarian purpose of getting work done. That's other creation stories. You can read those. Those are like the Babylonian gods. They created human beings because they needed products. They needed sacrifice. You weren't created for that, but you were created from the fruit of God's own love and his mere utter delight in doing it and having you. The whole of the universe, the whole of it springs from his eternal joy, delight, and play. In that upper corner there, that colorful one, if you can make it out with your eyes, it's really three people twirling. It's a picture of the Trinity. The whole of the universe comes from this dance and delight and joy and intimacy of the Trinity. The whole of it. It's where it comes from. And the playfulness, I think a lot of times it's hard for us to grasp, number one, because in the church we don't talk about it, but I think it's hard for us to grasp, especially as adults, because as adults, play and work have tragically been separated. Whereas in children, a lot of time you'll notice they become one experience. Like we could say this, children have unadulterated play. Say, work and play just kind of mingle together sometimes and become this single experience. I remember Peggy telling the story of her son, and Norm was really upset because he had told him to get to the trash. And if you've ever been their driveway, that's not necessarily an easy task. And he was putting on rollerblades, and Norm was so mad at him, but he was doing the trash. He was just making it fun. And Peggy had to tell him to chill out. He's doing what you ask. It doesn't matter how he does it. He's doing what you asked. See, children have this way of, it comes together as a single parent. And children play, and as they play, they're free from gauging the results, right? Their inner world is unhampered by any need to feel like, oh, I've got to produce, I've got to make this. But then as we age, you and I learn that persons are defined by what they do. We begin to think in our minds, work is more important than play. We use that language, relationships must work. We even think of prayer. Prayer has to produce results. Think of this. When a child asks the parent, will you play with me? In one sense, nothing's being done. Nothing's really being accomplished. But in reality, something crucial is achieved. Parent and child mutually affirm that they enjoy and prize each other. Nothing's being produced. Nothing's being done. It's kind of the Martha sitting at the feet of Christ. It's not Mary sitting at the feet of Christ. It's not Martha in the kitchen. But something is being done. But as we grow, we tend to make that rift between work and play. And with God, Walter Ong says this, such separation never comes. God's work is always play in the sense that it is always joyous, spontaneous, and completely free. I think if I were to tell you, like, so this series, we're going to look at, like, movies and literature and things that maybe we don't usually talk about in church. If you can get anything from the series, I hope it's this, that playfulness and holiness are inseparable. See, I was raised to think, no, a mature Christian is the serious, sober-minded. And those qualities aren't all bad. There's a time and place certainly for that. But don't we in our minds, oh, real follower of Jesus, like they sacrifice everything and they go to Africa and they... And I hope you are reminded at least that playfulness and holiness are inseparable. To be godly is to be full of joy. To be full of joy. Like, to show me a person who really banks on God's promises and his providence and resurrection and that death has been defeated, and there will be joy. There'll be laughter. There will be a sense of ease. So think of it, whether it's verbal play, whether it's aesthetic play, whether it's athletic play. It's hidden there even deep in our use of language because we say this, right? Athletes play the game. Musicians play their instruments. The best workers know how to somehow play at it. And I think if any rift we have in church, it's that on Sunday we come and there's this gap. What we confess, what we say we believe, we are saved by God's grace and faith, not works. But then our experience on Monday becomes sometimes a works righteousness. Something like Sunday, you're here, you're singing, you say, oh, God has justified us. God has accepted us. He's justified our existence. He's chased us down. He's placed his love on us all before we ever knew what was going on. It's free. It's of grace. But then on Monday, our actions sometimes betray a belief that our identity and worth are based entirely on what we do and how well we do it. And so our inability to play, our inability to experience holy leisure may stem from a lack of working in what Christ has worked out in history. What Christ has worked out in history is, it's finished, it's done. I've taken care of the root problems for you. But now we have to work that in. And until we do, we probably quite haven't been liberated from having to accomplish, having to work, having to perform for God. I'm going to end with this last quote. I'm thinking in my head. You can see wheels turning. So see, that's cool. Bob, I'll bring that back next week. I like that image. When I see that kind of stillness speaks to me of Sabbath. So you're missing a few things, but we'll come. That there is somebody's watercolor of the skyline of Indianapolis. Information that you will never use or need, but I give it freely anyway. But we'll end with this. I wanted to end with this quote. Jürgen Moltmann says this. And it kind of fit with what I was going to say about Sabbath and rest. When you think of Adam and Eve, think of this. Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day, and what came next? Seventh day was what? Rest. So their first experience of God's world is not work, but rest, Sabbath, ease. So we've got to find ways in our culture. Like to me, to be Christian, to be mature, is to find ways to stop, to rest, to experience Sabbath, to reflect on the work we, and here's why. Jürgen Moltmann says, existence precedes activity. So activity ends in simply being present. The celebration of the Sabbath leads to this intensified capacity for perceiving the loveliness of everything. Food, clothing, the body, the soul. Because existence itself is glorious. Questions about the possibility of producing something or about utility are forgotten in the face of the beauty of all created things, which have their meaning simply in themselves. That was a wordy way of saying you've got to have breaks, play in your life so that you can reflect back and see things not just for what they produce and do for you, but that they're lovely in and of themselves. They reflect their creator. And you will never see that if you are busy. I think Sharon, I wrote yours down too. Sharon wrote this quote, "Hurry is a form of violence practiced on time. But time is sacred." She didn't write it. I was going to give you credit though, but was it Eugene? Yeah, it was my man, Eugene. "Hurry is a form of violence practiced on time." That's why God built into the 7 weeks a day of saying, play. You weren't created just to do this. Play, play, reflect, and realize things are lovely because I made them, because they exist. Those flowers on a mountainside that no one ever sees, it's lovely because it reflects me. And God says, like a little child, do it again, do it again, do it again. Because he never grows old, never grows tired of daisies. He just says, make another one. We have sinned and grown old, and our father is younger than we. That's what Chesterton said. Father's younger than me. He's more like a child than us, and he's trying to lead us. That's what following Jesus is. He's trying to lead us back into childlike wonder. Father, thank you for, we look back at creation, this week of 7 days that you showed us a pattern and a rhythm of you created, you made, you produced, you fought off the forces of chaos, and you gave the world function and form, but then you rested. You sat on the throne as king over your cosmic temple, and that you invite us into this rhythm. And oh, how silly we are. It's like God lust. We feel so indispensable that we run around crazily, never stopping, never resting, never reflecting on the goodness just of existence. Let us be a people, like when we think about following you, when we think about holiness, when we think about what a mature Christian looks like, I think again in our culture, help us to be people that know how to rest, how to say no, how to play. That there is this sense of, yeah, there's difficult things in life, and there's also this sense of joy and ease because we believe the ultimate enemy has been crushed. You have crushed the serpent's head. And so there's a sense that that causes us to dance, to eat, to be in community, to go back to that garden kind of work,